Session number 22922, Martin Bell, part 2.
Many of the characters who appeared as sort of leading walkables during the fighting in the former Yugoslavia have been indicted and put on trial. Is this something that meets with your approval?
In principle, I approve of the War Crimes Tribunal, the principle behind it. I notice that many of the people against whom the most serious allegations have been made have not been brought in. Karadzic and Mladic, obviously. So it's a partial application of justice. And I have developed doubts about the procedures of the tribunal itself, the fact that it is a prosecutor's court, that in my view the playing field is not level, but it's easier for the prosecution than for the defence. There have been a large number of anonymous witnesses. I understand why, but it seems to be against the principles of natural justice. The wheels of justice there grind exceedingly slow, and that also, I think, restricts the rights of the individual. I mean, one of these characters was in jail for 2.5 years before his trial began. And then when the trial had started, it had been going on for about a year, one of the judges fell ill. The judges are fairly elderly. So he could have had the whole thing started again. This process could have gone on for many more years. So there are elements of the mechanisms being applied there that trouble me. My last speech as a member of parliament was typically in defence of the rights of alleged war criminals.
It appears that they don't use the Anglo-Saxon method of adversarial justice. They apply a different system. Do you know why that is?
Well, I don't mind not having the adversarial method of justice. I'm not a great I'm a fan of it. Why they went for this other system, I don't know, but I don't think there was any particular reason why British methods should prevail.
Do you think perhaps that if the Yugoslavs or the constituent parts of the former Yugoslavia had been offered the chance to run these things themselves, that might have been one way out, to allow the locals to try the crime as committed locally?
I think it would have been extremely difficult to have a series of separate courts. They would have been subject to the most ferocious political pressure, especially in the Serbian part of Bosnia and in Serbia itself. I approve the idea of an international criminal court, so long as it's fair, so long as it isn't victor's justice. There is a suspicion in this particular case that this is set up with hundreds of millions of dollars worth of UN money. And if it were to come up with one acquittal after another, people might then turn around and say, well, what's all this this money for? As we speak, so far as I know, not a single trial has resulted in the complete acquittal of any of the accused. And I think it'll be interesting to see, as time goes by, the extent to which the rights of the defendants are observed. And people are not convicted merely for notoriety. In the case of Milosevic, that's going to be a big test.
Do you approve of him being put on trial?
Yes. I believe personally that he was substantially responsible for the wars in Croatia and in Bosnia, which were in part wars of external aggression. I do find it difficult to see how, with his notoriety, with his tremendous mass of testimony against him, with it's going to be difficult he could well argue. He will argue that the court is not legally constituted. I think that's a difficult case to argue. A much easier case to argue is that he's been more or less found guilty before the trial has begun, found guilty in the court of world opinion, and what rights will he have to a fair and impartial hearing in the court in The Hague?
NATO intervened in the end, not the UN, with sort of heavy military groups, but NATO twice at the end of 1995 and again in Kosovo in 1999. Was that the right course of action for NATO to do?
I'm not a pacifist. I believe that the careful, proportionate application of force is sometimes necessary to prevent deaths on a wide scale, genocide, the destruction of whole communities. I think in this particular case, the time for the application of force was actually way back in November 1991, when Vukovar in Croatia was destroyed and Dubrovnik was bombed. Nothing happened. The wars took their course. And it took in Bosnia until, it was the end of August 1995 before the force was deployed, which actually worked, which in my view could have been deployed much earlier. There was great mythology of the indestructibility of the Serbs, dating from, I think, a false perception of what happened in the Second World War. And we weren't willing to take them on, and I think that we believed their propaganda about themselves, and we did them no service by allowing that to drag on as long as it did. I had my doubts about the bombing of civilian targets in Serbia, and indeed in Kosovo, in the NATO being willing to bomb from 15,000 feet but not have its boots on the ground. One of the effects of that is that many innocent people die, because at 15,000 feet you will not always be able to distinguish between a tractor and a tank. To me, a bridge is a civilian as well as a military target. A road is a civilian as well as a military target. So is an oil refinery. A television station is exclusively a civilian target. And if you bomb a television station, you have to ask yourself, why are you doing it? The reason given in Belgrade was that the television was telling lies. Well, to me, the answer to lies is not bombs. The answer to lies is truths. I think, frankly, that NATO committed some kind of a war crime in that matter.
How does one gauge the right proportional response to these crises if you are resolved on intervention? How do you work this one out, bearing in mind that the public doesn't want to take casualties and that there's this desire to get out of the situation once you're in it?
I think there is a more robust view about casualties among the public at large than there is among the politicians. You're dealing here with a group of politicians, certainly in the case of the United Kingdom, who know nothing about military life, who've never worn the Queen's uniform, not a single one of them, and take a rather peculiar view of casualties. I think every case is different. There is, under no circumstances, can there be a justification in bombing targets in which large numbers of civilians will certainly be killed. Anything near city centres, unless your position bombing is so precise that you can't take out a particular office in a particular Ministry of Defence building, and it's getting there. But I mean, to bring it up to date, if you're trying to avenge the deaths of 4,000 people in New York, you don't do it by claiming the lives of another 4,000 in Afghanistan. This is not a. If you do that, you are surrendering the values you're trying to defend.
Do you think we in the West have a large degree of responsibility, direct or indirect, for a lot of these conflicts taking place worldwide, where we see eruptions of violence leading to genocide, not only in the Balkans, Rwanda, East Timor, you name it?
Maybe we blame ourselves too easily. I think the former colonial powers in many of these cases have a heavy responsibility. The Portuguese, for instance, through their flight from Angola and Mozambique, they handed nothing on. They were bound to collapse into civil war. I think the British might still have some residual responsibility in Sierra Leone, and the British have lived up to that. I don't believe in blaming the West for every war in every collapsed state, but only the United Nations can prevent the bloodshed, often through a regional alliance like NATO. And the Western democracies, as far as military power is concerned and the provision of UN contingents, can provide troops of a higher quality than any others. And it's unfortunately one of the myths of UN peacekeeping that all armies are equal. Well, they're actually not. A small, well-motivated force can do much better. A force which looks as if it knows its business, and the British were that in Bosnia, can do much better than a force from a country whose sole imperative is not to take casualties.
Are we at the beginning of a period where this is going to be the pattern for future conflicts, interventions to halt bloodshed or
I hope that we are at the beginning of an age when we are willing to consider preemptive action, as has happened significantly in Macedonia in these past years, where war is stopped from breaking out by active intervention of some kind of multinational force. I would like to think that the 21st century will have a better record than the end of the 20th century in dealing with the wars in collapsed states. Again, it depends on the United Nations. Again, it depends on the willingness of the Security Council above all, and especially, I would say, the permanent members of the Security Council to live up to their responsibilities.
In that connection, you write very well about indifference. You quote Elie Wiesel, indifference is a sin. Can you expand on that point?
Elie Wiesel, of course, was, to my mind, the most eloquent survivor of the Holocaust. He saw his father, his whole family, taken away. I think he was 8 or 9 at the time of the liberation. He was in Auschwitz. And he wrote about it as only he could have done. And he always makes this point that it's easy to blame the Nazis, but for genocide to happen, it requires the indifference that lets it happen as well as the evil that makes it happen. Countries like ours looking on saying, well, we can't be sure, this is going on. There was no serious attempt made to save those people. And I think in a minor key, the same lessons apply to the ethnic cleansing and the limited genocide in Bosnia. Not only the evil that makes it happen, but the indifference that lets it happen. Take Srebrenica. We walked away. We walked away from the greatest war crime in Europe since 1945 because we were unwilling to risk our own soldiers, British, French, Dutch. And we rated the Bosnians who were killed, 7,000 of them, Bosnian Muslims, on a different scale of values, as if to say their lives are worth so much, but ours are worth so much more. Well, I think that's immoral, and it's a kind of indifference. We responded with a shrug of the shoulders, and we walked away. As in the case of the Dutch, they literally walked away.
You've seen Northern Ireland. You were there when the crisis started, and you had fires, in people's homes, people being torched out of their homes, or having to force, had to run away from their homes, and they were set on fire. Do you think we are immune in this country to the processes that you've observed elsewhere, particularly in Boston?
We've had some terrible experiences with the Northern Ireland conflict. I remember doing a program which was called 5 Years, 1,000 Deaths. 1,000 people died in the first 5 years. There would be, in some years, it would be 200 or 300. But still, I wouldn't put it on quite the scale of the Balkan Wars. The brutality was certainly on a smaller scale. The Irish, I think, understood each other better. They understand each other better. A peace process was set in motion, which has made a difference. Nomenclature matters. Censorship matters. I was censored in Northern Ireland when the Roman Catholics were burned out of their homes in the first year, in Belfast. And I wasn't allowed to identify them as Roman Catholics. The then commander-in-chief, whatever his name was, of the BBC in Belfast, controller Northern Ireland, old TV newsman, forbade me to do it because he said we'd be stirring up trouble in the streets that night. So they weren't called Catholics, they were called refugees. And you wouldn't have known they were Catholics except that I managed to include a shot of a refugee pushing a pram with her worldly possessions on the pram, and on top of the pram was a crucifix.
You covered very briefly in the period before you went back to Bosnia after you were wounded in 1902, the plight of Romanian gypsies in Germany. That made you recall that, you described it in your book.
What was I doing in Germany?
And you were in Germany and you came across a story about Romanian gypsies. And
And
that seemed to set off a shiver, a recognition of earlier forces that we all know about.
I was surprised. They sent me to Germany to cover the liberation of the old Eastern Bloc states. And I was surprised when these great rallies they held in a place like Halle or Dresden, you'd look out over a sea of white faces. It was racially homogenous, except maybe for a few Vietnamese students. And suddenly, The Romanian gypsies started coming in across the border, and the reaction to them was visceral and elemental. And it was a time, I suppose, of revolution, in which the two halves of Germany were economically uneven, as they still are, and there was almost an underclass, especially of young people in the former German Democratic Republic, who responded very much to a sense of threat from outside, and the neo-Nazi movement, I would be inclined to take very seriously. You saw where it drew its inspiration. I mean, it was maybe a tiny percentage, but it was not negligible.
Do you see similar forces working in this country?
I'm concerned by racial outbreaks of racial trouble in Oldham and elsewhere. I don't think it's on that scale. I don't want to be alarmist about it. Our politicians are not having much truck with it. Though, if you look at the success of the British National Party in Oldham, it's actually quite worrying. But again, I take a libertarian position on this. In my view, in a British Parliament, if the British National Party stayed within the law and got 5% of the votes, it would be entitled to 5% of the seats. I don't think that the extreme right is well dealt with by repressing it. That's what they tried to do in East Germany. And it gathered strength from this, from persecution, much in the manner, perhaps, of a persecuted church.
And they derived much of their argument from refugees, as they say, flooding into this country. Is that a perception which owes any reality?
As a matter of statistics, there's actually much more reality to it in Germany than there is in the United Kingdom. Germany, I believe, took something like 400,000 Bosnian refugees. They bore the brunt of this huge influx of refugees. Now, these were genuine refugees from war. But when the war is over, the question then arises, do they go home? And many of them are reluctant to do so. So there was a real problem in Germany in the sense that it's much smaller here. You know, we're surrounded by a moat. And the moat may be under siege on the far side of the Channel, but it's still... it's easier to control our borders than that of any other country on the continent of Europe.
If in fact actually these ethnic conflicts are the wars of the future, how do we adjust our policies to deal with the consequences like refugees, for example?
I think we have to go back to first, I mean, we are now faced with the consequences not just of a war in Afghanistan, but of a huge drought, in which the neighbouring countries, large parts of Pakistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, are vast dust bowls. In Tajikistan, 1 million people are facing starvation this winter. Now, as long as those conditions prevail, and we're not going to help them, you're going to have great tides of refugees going all over the world. The refugees trying to land on the coast of Australia were Afghans. There is no way to tackle these problems but at their root, with massive foreign aid on a scale we haven't even thought of before. The world's population is expanding. There's increasing competition for scarce water resources. And I think that the wars of the world are going to be wars of survival by people just grabbing resources. And we can't just sit back, it seems to me, and say, well, here we are, we've got a nice comfortable moat around us. If we leave the world alone, it will leave us alone because it won't. And that's the lesson of the 11th of September. It won't.
Is there any evidence, actually, that kind of thinking is keen to get into governments as opposed to a military reaction?
Well, actually, the military are actually quite good at delivering civilian aid because they're pretty bloody-minded about having to get it through. I wouldn't necessarily make a political-military distinction there. Whether the politicians can move the people, I don't know. I fought an election campaign in an Essex constituency in April and May, in which not a single question was raised about any issue of foreign policy except the common European currency. Not one. Nothing about third world debt or terrorism or or the increasingly desperate condition of so many people in so many countries, or the United Nations. Well, I'd like to think if we had a general election now, some of these questions would be raised.
Just one question for me. One of your chapters, you end with the sort of the cry, arm your children, in relation to the inability of outside forces to sort of be relied upon to actually come to your help when things really get tough. It seems to be a rather pessimistic cry. I mean, is that something you feel very strongly, that if all else fails, you...
If all else fails, arm your children. This was certainly the case in Bosnia, where you could see many underage soldiers. It's one of the phenomena of our time, the child soldier. And there's a reason for it, that the modern assault rifle is actually quite light and portable. The old Lille Enfield 303, on which I trained and was the mainstay of the British Army for 100 years, a kid couldn't use it. It was literally not child's play. But the phrase, arm your children, I acquired from a very pessimistic and splendid writer man, Kurt Schork, who was the Constance in residence of the UN press, of the Foreign Press Corps in Sarajevo, and who survived all that and was later killed in a tin pot ambush in Sierra Leone.
Anything you want to think about it? Just to pick up sentences, actually, if you could explain who Ustasha and Ante Pavlich are.
Just wait for the aircraft because there's going to be a drop in.
So. Okay. You don't need any buzz track after this, do you?
I've just got one.
Okay.
One of the things that surprised me was the power of nationalism. One of the things that surprised me was the power of nationalism across the years. Tito had actually tried to forge this new nation living in brotherhood and unity. All these peoples which forget their separate national identities. Well, after 50 years, the flags come out, the songs come out. On the backs of the cars in Herzegovina, the Croatian, mainly Croatian area, you find these pictures of Ante Pavelić, who was the leader of the Ustasche, the puppet Nazi state in Germany under Hitler. It was as if nothing had changed and nothing had been learned.
In just a sentence with Srebrenica.
Srebrenica was one of the great scandals of our times. The worst war crime since 1945, in which 7,000 Muslim men were taken away and murdered in cold blood, executed. There's no doubt that it happened, although a lot of the bodies have still not been found. And it happened in what was allegedly a UN safe area, in a country, Bosnia, which had 34,000 UN troops based in it at the time. So it's a standing reproach to us, especially the Western democracies, who had many soldiers there, that we just stood back and let it happen. And we knew it would happen. We knew it would happen. It happened because, if this is an extenuating circumstance, I don't know, but in January 1993, there was a massacre of Serbs at a village called Bratunac, right on the Bosnian-Serb border. It was done by Muslims, and the Serbs blamed the people of Srebrenica, collectively, the Muslims of Srebrenica, for that massacre. And when they'd taken Srebrenica, there was no doubt what was going to happen to the people whom they held responsible collectively. They were going to be murdered, and they were.
Thank you very much.
Always somber stuff, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.